Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of Kyle and Patrick's Yet To Be Named podcast. I am Patrick McEwen, a.k.a. the Lacrosse Film Room guy, here with Inside Lacrosse's gear and lifestyle editor, Kyle Devitt. I think finally we're done talking about getting a sponsorship and name for the podcast. So let's delve right into it. The big news coming up this weekend is the USA men's team is having, I guess, what do you want to call it? Is it a showcase? It's part of the tryout process, but not necessarily the tryouts.
Right. It's more US Lacrosse is opening their new facility and they needed kind of a showpiece. And this is part of their showpiece. And what a showpiece to begin with. You know, MLL versus MLL. You had a lot of, you know, tryouts with all these pro players fresh off their season. Some guys freshly rested, some guys right off a championship weekend, ready to jump into it.
So any thoughts about the roster? Anything that immediately sticks out to you?
There's so many short stick D-middies. Like, I know there's a theme of like me picking on D-middies. And sorry for that. I just think there's some guys on here that I don't know if they're going to be around for the championships. It's kind of like World Cup qualifying, because that actually happened this past week. It's international. Again, this is me bringing up soccer, which is going to be a theme on the podcast. They had all the World Cup qualifying for 2018, Russia. And you see guys that are like 36 or like 35. I mean, with lacrosse, it's different. There aren't a lot of those guys out there that are still playing. The shelf life is much shorter. But, you know, you see guys like, I mean,
was it the big one? Joe Walters is the oldest guy. Was on the 2006 team, but not the 2010 or 2014 teams.
Right. And that was a internal kind of feud action. I mean, you got Matt Danowski. He's 08. Again, like you said, Joe Walters. I mean, you got Beast on here, 06, Penn State.
That's true.
Unterstein is 08. And I think that's, there's some puzzling stuff on here. Like, where are we going with, in terms of, vetting in new talent. I mean, that being said, this is the most surprising name on here is Jacob Richard from the Lizards, formerly Marquette, but that's because Amplo's an assistant, right?
That makes sense.
So that makes a lot of sense. Will Hawes, who was oft injured all season for the Hounds. I mean, that's tough. You know, he was on and off. You know, there's a lot of guys like that kind of stick out. John LoCascio on here is pretty cool. I mean, yeah, there's like several LSMs on here masquerading as D guys. Chad Wiedmeyer's kind of surprising given the season he had. Drew Adams, I don't think is going to be playing much longer. So I think that's kind of the only weird goalie one. But, otherwise, super solid, roster. Phipps is a little surprising, but he had a solid year. But you know, it's going to be great players going up against each other, trying to impress the new coaching staff.
Yeah. So my one outside of the short stick D-mids, which you hit on pretty much my thoughts there. I feel like I'm not sure that these attackmen, not that any of them don't deserve to be here, but it seems like they went with the best eight guys rather than trying the guys who would build the best team.
Well, at least they got lefties this time.
That's true.
You know, they've neglected to pick lefties in the past. McArdle finally gets the call. Will Manny finally gets the call.
They have four. It's four and four now.
Yeah, that's new for them. You know, but those two guys stand out to me is Manny and McArdle, getting a chance.
And Sankey and Crotty are the other lefties. You have four, and then yeah. Danowski, Holman, Eric Law, and, Rob Pinnell are the righties.
Yeah, and Crotty and Danowski are swingmen, right? Like they can play midfield as well. So, yeah, I think it's, I don't know how Peter Baum's on here with his injured hamstring. I'm surprised that hasn't been changed.
This came out before, this roster came out before he injured his hamstring, didn't it?
It did, yeah, but there hasn't been a replacement announcement. There probably doesn't need to be. Miles Jones on here, your guy. I believe you did some highlighting for him this week.
Yeah, I did. On Monday came out with, my Miles Jones, rookie highlights from the MLL.
You know what I noticed from that highlight package? He's so big.
Like, oh, yeah. Yes.
He's a monster. Just watching kind of him run full speed is, you know, I mean, he doesn't do it all that often. So when you see him explode for goals, you're like, oh, wow. Like, imagine, you know, that for, you know, on the other side of the ball, even. Not that he really plays a lot on the other side of the ball, but, you know, seeing his explosion when he's got the ball in his stick, he's one of those players that, you know, and this isn't a dig, it probably sounds like one, but he's one of those players that's faster when the ball's in his stick. You know?
That's what, I just think, to me, he's a guy that, when you look at him, so many guys who have sort of his physical stature as Dodgers are either power guys or speed, like, are kind of sort of power, sort of downhill speed guys. Right. And the tricky thing about him to realize is he's a quickness guy.
Yeah.
That he's, it's the start stop that he can, you can be 2 yards away from him facing him straight up in great position and he can jab step and blow by you from a standstill. There's not a lot of guys who are that big who can do that, which that's what makes him, I think, so special to me.
Yeah. It's like him and Rabel, you know, and,
but no,
and
even, got- even, I mean, Rabel is just an everything guy, but I feel like Rabel to a certain extent is still like, Rabel can do that, has the quickness to do that, but he's still more of a straight line speed guy than Miles Jones.
Well, he's also a fader too. Like he'll fade out of the dodge and Jones never fades out of his dodge. Right?
No, that's very true. That's true.
That's the one thing. Like he never fades to feed. I mean, talking about quickness guys do that all the time. Like Jordan Wolf's really good at that.
Yes.
Joe Walters
his
is
step
very,
back down GLE. Jordan Wolf's is incredible.
Yeah. And so is Walters. Walters exceptional at that. I mean, we're talking about guys that can kind of make this roster that are older. I mean, Walters can play just based on his stick skill for a while, you know, and the fact that he's a lefty, you know, gives a lot of, you know, value to his skill set, I think. Not too much, but like enough that like he's in the mix here. And in the past, we haven't seen him in the mix. And he, as you noted, missed out on two teams where he was clearly good enough to be on both those teams. It was just a personality conflict.
Yeah. I mean, when you think about it, in terms of I want to say he's the only, there's a bunch of lefties that attack. So lefties aren't necessarily an issue with this team, but he's the only lefty midfielder, I believe.
Yeah, I mean, Rabel's both hands.
Oh, yeah, not that they lack left-handed shots. I mean, Shriver can shoot rip it lefty. I mean, they have plenty of guys, like Chanichuk, Baum, Miles Jones all have lefty shots. All have very good lefty shots.
Yeah, I would say Baum is probably up there as well. What do you think about the face-off guys, though? Your guy Matez, not on here. What's up with that? Coaching?
But
Maryland, right?
That's a good question. I don't know. I haven't talked to him about it. But I mean, I think you can make an argument that he's not one of the four best guys.
So you think this is the four best guys right now? Pascolgin, Nardella, Garanley, and Fowler?
The tricky thing, honestly, is I think some of it, you gotta look at, it's international rules. The rules are so different at different levels that it's,
right.
That to say who's the best guy, you really almost need to specify under what rule set are we talking.
Yeah.
To talk about who the four best guys are. And no, and I don't think that these for certain are the four best guys, but I think you can make an argument that they are. It's close.
Yeah.
I think it's close. Like, I think if you are talking, he's in the conversation.
Yeah.
With these four guys. But I think you could, a reasonable person could look at the MLL faceoff scene and decide these are the four best guys and have Mattis fifth.
Yeah, I mean, statistically, I mean, you got to include like Drew Simoneau on there too, you know, statistically speaking. There was some guys that had a better end of season than beginning too. If you're paying super close attention to faceoff stuff, which in the MLL, less so because everyone, knows that the shot clock's there. So your possession time is lower. So your possessions have a little less value.
The differential, there are a couple teams that don't have a face-off guy, but the other 7 of the 9 teams or 8 of the 9 teams have a decent face-off guy. Whereas
right.
In college, the disparity is enormous sometimes.
Sure. And
that
even,
they're really, as you mentioned, sort of even a 60-40 split in the MLL isn't going to win or lose you the game.
Correct.
And that's really, aside from Grenlian last year, you really don't have anybody who's going 65-70% like you sometimes do in Division One.
So, I mean, who else would you, I mean, Jordan Wolf is injured, torn hamstring, getting
right.
Surgery.
Right. Well, to me, as I was saying, I just feel like they're lacking on attack. You don't necessarily have, there's no guys really, I would say Marcus Holman is the most, is the least ball dominant guy.
Eric Law?
Eric Law is another, is the other sort of off ball guy, but you don't really have necessarily a crease guy or like a wing shooter.
Will Manny is an amazing off ball player. He's my dark horse pick in whatever game they're playing, like however it's going to break down, to have like a lot of goals, because his underrated skill is backdoor cutting and also finishing from tight angles. And you saw when teams took that away from him and took him out of the Canons, offensive play by either short sticking him, and just ISOing on him, defensively locking off, the Canons had far less success than they did when teams tried to play him straight up and he wasn't the primary ball handler.
So that's true.
I think he's an excellent guy.
That wasn't necessarily to knock any of those guys' off ball skills. It's just that when you think of, I mean, I guess when I think of Will Manny this past year for the Canons, I think of him with the ball, sort of running, coming off, sweeping off of picks, that kind of thing.
He definitely had the ball a lot more in his stick this year. That's fair. And he even played midfield in a couple games running out of the box to kind of switch up his looks with the ball to see what he could do in different parts of the field. He's out in Utah already doing some coaching. Some pictures out there.
Yeah, he and Marcus Holman are both out there now.
Yeah, looks like God's country out there, man. I'm a little jealous.
Oh yeah, yes. The elevation, you're used to the elevation, but those mountains are a gorgeous backdrop.
Yes, very much so. Anything else that jumps out to you on this roster, real quick? Guys you want to see?
I think it's with attack. The one guy I was curious that, like, when you think about it, a guy who is that kind of off-ball guy, I was wondering if you could see Ryan Brown.
But that's interesting. He's going to be in the mix. You know, I think he has the tools to do it, and he would be a great, I think what Ryan Brown could develop into is a Kevin Lavelle type player.
He's already a great, he's already a fantastic inside finisher.
Yeah, he's got more range than Lavelle too, but he doesn't have the, kind of deception that Lavelle had yet. He's a lot more power and location than he is dropping a shoulder and pushing the ball through.
His stick though, like Kevin Lavelle, was like a very little whip.
Yeah, shallow pocket.
Got kind of guy. And Ryan Brown is a deep pocket. I want to say he did a weapon of choice for inside lacrosse. And, he was quoted as saying his whip on a scale of 1 to 10, his whip is an 11.
Yes. He did say that. Weapon of choice. So
he's playing with his stick is the Spinal Tap of whip.
Fair enough.
I just think he's so versatile though, the inside, outside finisher, lefty and righty. If you're gonna put a guy on your roster, to be primarily an off-ball guy, in terms of a skill set, it's hard to think of anyone better.
Yeah, I think the other thing.
He meshes, he can play off of any of these guys.
Yeah, he can play off of anybody. I mean, he just has to get the right lane. He just needs a lane to goal.
Right.
You know? I think the thing we touched on earlier is actually worth touching on again. This is short stick demon is, I mean, how is Dominique Alexander not on here? I know we have our differences with the man, but how is Josh Hawkins not on here? Like, I get it, but I don't get it at the same time. Like,
my thought with him, you're playing, he is a fantastic MLL short stick D-mid because of what he brings in transition.
Right.
But the international game is so anti-transition that I think, I'm not sure if under international rules, he's necessarily the guy you want.
I mean, if that's true, then Steve DiNapoli doesn't have a place on here. And I mean, he's straight up transition. I mean, Jake Bernhardt plays good defense, but he's better at transition than he is one-on-one defense. In my opinion, I mean,
that's certainly a fair criticism. I would say the rationale in my mind for not including Josh Hawkins on it. If you're going to put, you know, picking six short stick D-mids to play under the international rules, I think that would be in it. Like you said, there's some of the guys, maybe that criteria wasn't fairly applied to the other guys, but that would be what I would say is the most logical explanation for why he wouldn't be here.
I mean, Mike Evans too, great player. I don't think he's going to be around in 2 years. I mean, he's just so injured all the time. And also Landis, I know you love the Notre Dame guys and I like Notre Dame guys too, but like Landis did not have a good season in Florida. I'm sorry. Like no one on Florida had a good season really, except for like Austin Kaut. You know, like I think this is like guys that they want to see if it's the team that they were on that they didn't play well or if it's, you know, something more than that. So, it's going to be interesting. I think to see certain guys, how they pair certain guys up, defensively is probably the most interesting thing that we'll see.
Yeah, it's a question of who, as you mentioned, there's a bunch of like LSM, Jesse Bernhardt, Kyle Hartzell, LaCascio, Scott Ratliff, Joel White. You have a bunch of LSM guys, and I don't think you have room to play all of them at LSM.
I don't see a lot of help defenders on here either. I mean, Landis and Bernhardt and Fletcher are the only help defenders I see on here. You know, guys that, you know, play off the ball and ball hawk and shadow and fill spots in our two slides as well as they are one slides and in the right position a lot. You see a lot of these guys aren't like that and are one ball guys and on ball cover guys.
When you talk about like Matt Landis, that actually is a, like, I mean, he's playing with Tucker Durkin, so it's not like he necessarily is always on the top cover guy, but, he's one of the few guys who was the top cover guy in Division One, but who also could translate into a very high level, like third defender who's playing an off ball, mostly off ball role.
Right. And he should be a two in the MLO on the team with Durkin, still, I believe.
Well, I would just say it's more that you don't want Tucker Durkin is the if you think sort of Ricardian trade theory, Tucker Durkin is so much better on ball than off ball that you'd be silly not to put him in a primarily on ball role relative to Matt Landis.
Right. I mean, he has trouble with super quick guys. So like, I wouldn't put him on Sankey, for example, but
that's
I would
true.
Probably
that's
put
true.
Him on like McArdle and I would put him on. Yeah. I'd put him on McArdle and Pinnell probably more than anyone else. Cause he's a guy that handles the versatility of a player better than the, athleticism of a player. And I think there's a lot of, players that are athletic on this squad, but I think the focus going forward is going to be less on athleticism. And like you said, the international game, less transition means athleticism means less. So you're looking to a lot more cerebral players. You're looking for guys that can score in the six and understand not just two-man game, but, you know, strong side, weak side ball, plays and diagnosis.
Yes. And just like, as you mentioned, smarts that are long, grinding out long possessions against the Canadians.
Right, and not getting tired mentally from that, for
right.
sure.
And just being able to realize, like, figuring out what matchup are the Canadians trying to get to attack, you know, and how can we deny them that matchup, and if it's the case, you know, that making a lot of those decisions, you're going to have a long time to think about them on the defensive end, potentially, in a hypothetical gold medal game.
Yeah, and, you know, if you're building your team just to beat Canada, which you should be, you gotta get your schemes up. And I think, you know, this change in the coaching staff is pointing towards that direction instead of where it was in the last World Championships. That's diplomatic, right? I did that right.
It was so diplomatic, I'm not completely sure what point you were trying to make.
Excellent. That's what I wanted. That's what I was going
for. I'd have to think about it again. I need to go back and listen to hear what exactly you said to figure out what you were alluding to, because it was that diplomatic.
Awesome. I'm getting better at that. That's good. That's a skill I'm working on. Any other thoughts on this before we move on?
No, I think we're ready to move on to a subject that I wanted to address very briefly that came up on Twitter last night about why as I said, I started with me tweeting about why I don't really like to take suggestions or requests from people about videos to make. And it's because, for the most part, people are terrible at requesting videos.
What does that mean? So, like, what requests are you getting? Like, make my highlight tape? Like, what are they asking for?
Just, like, and so it becomes a frustrating thing whenever I post videos, and so of what, basically whenever I post, people want more of it, but just like with different players. So when I posted like those Miles Jones highlights, and I posted ones, I'm doing in the middle of the, by the time you listen to this, probably all of the FOA ones are up, all the Faceoff Academy guys. I did Matters on Tuesday, Grenlian today on Wednesday, and Brendan Fowler's highlights are coming tomorrow. People just post, I want do this guy, I want highlights from this guy, here's four guys, do all their highlights, please. People don't say please, most of the time they're just like, do these highlights, because I get to tell you what to do.
It's funny because people want more of what you do and less of what I do. So that's good. People wanting more of something is better than people wanting less. Less hot takes, Kyle. Less of you freaking out, Kyle. That's what people want from me. So you can look at it the other way too, which is
you. I do always enjoy it, but it's just the thing. People have no idea like what film I have and what's going to take me hours to access. And then people have no idea, you know, what I'm working on and that kind of thing. And it's sort of one of those things that there's so much information that you don't have when you're just looking at the videos that you're not really in position to know what's going to be a good video. It's right. Like, I always think about it the way, what's the Henry Ford quote? That if I asked my customers what they wanted, they would have said faster horses.
Yeah, that's a good point.
That it's always that way, that people, nobody knew they wanted film room matchup videos until I made them.
It's true. You gotta respect the creation of the source of the material. I mean, and also, like, people just think that's all you do. People think that's all you do, is make videos. You're a video guy. Make me videos, monkey boy. Make me some videos.
That also
gets do me. Tricks for me. Do you do tricks for people?
No.
No. Not even wall ball tricks, Patrick. Do you do wall ball tricks?
For the first time, I was inspired by Tom Schreiber like a week and a half ago, and I tried some left hand around the worlds.
How'd that go?
I managed to hit the wall on the first five that I tried.
It's great.
And then, after a couple more, I managed to complete, three in a row.
There you go.
Where
See?
I threw it, hit the wall, and I caught the ball without it hitting the ground again. Three times in a row. So, I was pretty impressed. I don't know how that stacks up to other people's standards for offhand around the worlds, but I it was better than my expectations were going in.
First try, it's probably pretty good. So basically what you're saying is you're doing these videos, you're doing them for the players, you're doing them for you, and people want you to do stuff for them. And I think they don't understand that.
No, when I like had included this for things we're gonna talk about on the podcast, where I was going is just, in general, I'm not big on, taking requests or questions from listeners, and I think we just, it's one thing I want to address in the podcast that we're not going to add a question segment.
Right.
Because my attitude on the whole thing is just that if I can't come up with better questions to ask you than our listeners, then I shouldn't be hosting the podcast. My whole
Patrick,
job.
What did I text you last night?
I forget. What did you text me?
Pull it up. You can read it. I want you to read it to the people. Cause it's a philosophy I've had for a very long time.
Oh, I remember now. Here it is. A person is smart. People are stupid.
Yes. Large groups of people, regardless of their knowledge base, upbringing, education, anytime you get a large grouping, it's a problem. It's a problem because mob mentality wins out. A single thought, a single entity, and a couple people together. You made this point that a couple people can be smart. That's true. A couple people have a podcast here, and we're talking. So, a couple people can be smart, but groupthink is nearly always stupid. It just, in my opinion, it's not just lacrosse. In, like, life. Any groupthink, if I listen to all the groupthink that has been around me growing up in super conservative New Hampshire, I would not be, you know, I'd be a banker. I'd be like, you know what I mean?
We're getting off topic though.
No, we're not, because listen to my point.
I don't know what it is. So
I know you don't know what it is. That's why I'm going to explain it, because it's abstract. Okay. So the group think of you should do this, you should do this. And it's always the same phrasing of it is not valid, right? To you, because you value the thing that you're putting out as a commodity, correct? You're not just doing a service.
I think you're not just doing a service. I think you're still talking about making videos. I was talking about this podcast.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, I'll take questions from anybody, but like, prepare for the repercussions from that. Do you know what I mean?
That's all I was saying. People can send us questions, but like, I might read them, and I definitely don't promise to ever ask you any of them or answer any of them on the podcast.
Oh, I mean, I'll answer questions on Twitter all day long. It's just people don't, you know, if they're not intelligent questions, I'm not answering them. So right. that's my point. Like, a person can send a question, but you're encountering the groupthink of all these people sending you the same suggestion, right? Or like suggestions that have no merit.
There's different suggestions, but it's just they all, and it's like on Twitter, on YouTube, on Instagram, like all these different platforms, people are all request, like, it happens every time I post like a video. Just people request stuff that it's always just more like this video. And it's like, no, you don't understand why, like, I made this video and why, like, what specifically about it. And like, whatever, like, matchup you're requesting like an off-ball finisher versus a defender. He never dodged against him. You just don't know that because you didn't watch the game.
Well, explain that. Like, elaborate on that so people understand why you're having your hardline position.
No, it doesn't matter. I was trying to talk about this podcast and you're still talking about videos.
I like to bring it back to the source of everything, man.
That wasn't the source, though.
Yeah, it was the source of your concern, is people asking for
video
stuff.
No, it wasn't it. Like, that inspired it, but...
So you don't want to take questions from people on Twitter or on the podcast?
That's what I've been trying to say for, like, 5 minutes.
Why?
Because I don't think people ask good questions. I'm not going to waste my time looking for questions and soliciting them. I'll just come up with my own questions. It'll be better than those questions.
See, you know what I think it is? I think your audience is a lot different than my audience in terms of Twitter. Because your audience is built from people wanting to see videos.
No, this applies to everything.
You think it does? I don't think it applies to everything. I don't think so. I think the people that follow me aren't just fans.
I think question segments are the worst segments with podcasts in general, or like taking calls if you're a radio show. It's just because people can't come up with any better content to have.
I mean, that's certainly a take. I don't think I agree with that. I think there's
that's the take I've been trying to get at for like this entire
and I don't
time.
I don't share it. So we're having a disagreement here.
Okay.
That's what the podcast is sort of founded on as well, is actual discussion and disagreement. And I disagree that we won't take any ever. I don't think that's fair.
I didn't say we didn't. No, I didn't. It's not a hardline stance. Like, if somebody asks us questions, maybe somebody will inspire something that we need to address, like with a question. But
sure.
It's not going to be. My point was, it's not going to be a regular segment.
Yeah, and that's fair. Like, we shouldn't bow to the pressure of having segments ever. Like, we're just going to create our own thing, and people are going to like it or they're not. You know, I mean,
yes. It's
at least it's something. At least someone's trying. You know,
okay.
We're not just like rolling the ball out.
I think
that's
we've
good.
Rambled enough on this subject that
people like the rambling. That's the
Do
thing
they?
You don't like.
Do they? I don't know that I like the rambling.
I know you don't like it. That doesn't mean the people don't like it. See, listen, if you guys like the rambling, shoot us a Twitter mention.
There's so much non-rambling things that I have to say. Can we ramble on about
give an example. What's the next thing? What's the next thing you need to say that's non-rambly?
Because
the next thing we're going to talk about is basically you rambling. So,
no, it's a rant. That's different than rambling.
Okay.
Like,
the veracity of it is different. I understand.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. The veracity of it, and I have somewhere that I'm headed with this, and I have a point that needs to be made. Rambling, there were no more points that needed to be made. Honestly, that entire last, like, topic that we discussed really didn't need to be discussed at all.
Oh, I know. I was just poking you the whole time. That's why it was fine.
I know.
The listeners know, too. The listeners know, too. That's why they enjoyed it.
I know, that's why I kept trying to just end it.
I know, that's why I kept not letting you do that. But what I am going to do is I'm going to step aside here, and I'm going to let you go on your thing that you feel very passionately about. And I'm not going to say a word.
Okay.
You go.
Well, no, you can say a word. This is a give and take. It's a back and forth. So this weekend, like many of you, I watched some college football. And there were a couple of incidents, where there were helmet-to-helmet hits. Most prominently on, was it Monday night, the Notre Dame-Texas game? Yes.
Yes.
Sunday night.
Sunday night. No, that was Monday.
Monday was Florida State,
You're right, Sunday night. Whatever.
Sunday night. And so the the helmet-to-helmet hit that knocked out, Torrey Hunter Jr. that didn't get, a penalty. Anyways, and so, this is something, and it certainly doesn't apply to everyone, and I think most people have reached the point now in 2016 where they get it, that head injuries and helmet-to-helmet hits, but there still are a stunning number of people who just don't get it when it comes to concussions and head-to-head hits. And this rant is not so much about college football, but more as it applies to lacrosse, where especially you're talking big hits and helmet-to-helmet hits just have no... There's no need for them in lacrosse. And it's a huge impediment to the growth of the sport to have them still existing in the sport where it's a concern for parents in terms of what they sign up for their kids, to have the number of players that we still have missing time due to concussions from helmet to helmet hits. There's just no reason for it in the sport. It's not reliant like football is on that kind of hard-hitting person-to-player-to-player contact. And so, for people, who don't get it, I guess I'm not totally sure that there's anything that could be said that hasn't been said already to make you get it. But, you know, you really need to get with the times when it comes to helmet-to-helmet hits and concussions and the problems that they present for a sport, even an established sport like football, and especially for a growing sport like lacrosse. Okay, and that's my rant.
Wow. As someone that sustained his 10th concussion this summer, most of them came when I was a kid because I just like fell a lot. But I've had 10. I've only had a couple that were super severe and caused me to like lose memory. I should say, but there really is no such thing as a small concussion. And I think as someone that dealt with it as a coach and having players go through older. So I was a coach long enough to kind of see the progression from, the original protocols, which were just like dilated pupils and like speech and walking a line or whatever, to what it is now, which is a lot more cognitive stuff. You take a baseline test at the beginning of the season. You get tested after that to see how bad see if you have a concussion, not even how bad it is, based on those baseline tests as well as the regular, physical tests. Concussions aren't something to mess around with, and they're not anything to joke about. Obviously people primally are going to be drawn to big hits, regardless of the sport. And lacrosse delivers big hits on occasion. You know, low-level lacrosse, you'll see a lot more big hits because the ball's on the ground. The more the ball's on the ground, the better the chance for a big hit. Because awareness with the ball is one of the first things you're taught as a lacrosse player, right?
Well, and just, it's impossible to pick up. I always think it's funny when some kid, like, when there's a video or something. Not funny, I think it is sort of sad, but also ironic, that people, the coaching advice that goes out is stay down on the ground ball, but also pick your head up and look around. Cause you can't do both.
Correct.
It's really hard to pick up a ground ball with proper technique that gets coached and be looking up to see, you know, that there's a guy coming to hit you.
That's why everyone picks up the ball one-handed.
Yeah, which is one of those things that when I first saw a Canadian do it, it kind of puzzled me, but it makes sense when you watch, the more you watch box lacrosse and you see them having to pick up ground balls on the boards because you can't bend over and stick your head
no
down next to the boards where you might get hit or bumped into the boards head first.
Right, and it's also easy to for someone to come over the top on you and hit you in the neck or arm or whatever when you do that. So, yeah, I think you know, it's the thing about as people I know, like my sisters have kids, stuff like that. As I talk to them about what they're going to let their kids play, I think the next generation of kids, there's going to be a lot less kids playing football and kids that are going to want a contact sport. Hockey's still more expensive than lacrosse. Lacrosse is the next, that's part of why lacrosse grows, right? Isn't that like, why aren't we talking about that more? Lacrosse grows because it's safer than football.
Yeah, I think it's
and
also
it's more exciting than baseball.
To me though, fundamentally is it's, I don't even think so much the contact. I think it's in a lot of ways, it's a fast paced, exciting sport where, average body types can be very successful.
Oh, so you're advocating lacrosse is like for the dad bods? I mean
not dad bod, but like where a 5'8" player can be very successful in lacrosse. It's yeah. very hard to be 5'8" and be successful in football or basketball.
I know that, Patrick.
I am aware.
that is more truer words were never spoken. I think
so to me, like the range, whatever your genetics are, aside from, I mean, obviously being faster, stronger, quicker are all more helpful, but you can overcome, for the most part, most people can overcome their genetics to be very good high school lacrosse players. Not everyone can there are only so many kids can play point guard on the basketball team.
Right. Corner or wide receiver in football.
Right. There's only so many spots to be, you know, 5'8", 5'9", 5'10", and be successful. And if you're not incredibly quick or have, you know, can jump really high, you're going to have a hard time being a very good high school basketball player if you're 5'10", which is the average height. But if you're 5'10", you can play any position you want in lacrosse.
That's true.
And if you're just a pretty good athlete, you know, who works hard, you can be very successful in high school lacrosse without, you know, superior natural athletic genetics, which is to me why it grows. Anyways, one last topic. I think we'd sort of rambled off of helmet to helmet hits and concussions. One last topic that we're going to talk about is, as we get into fall ball, a lot of college teams are starting, and the ones that haven't are going to be starting soon. You'll start to see some, and for the most part, it all comes from inside lacrosse, because let's be honest, they're pretty much the only ones who are sending people to watch fall practices and scrimmages in the lacrosse media. But as you start to see reports coming out of fall ball, in terms of who's looking good, or what teams are playing well, what players, I just want to sort of prep people, what do you think is meaningful or most meaningful kind of observations that get made during fall ball?
Considering I don't think there's a lot of them, I'm going to focus on just a couple. I think fall ball is more for coaches than players. And what I mean by that is one of the things you'll see a lot of turnaround in any college sport, especially, is the assistant coaches. You won't see a ton of high profile head coach movings or relocations in, you know, college lacrosse as opposed to like football or basketball in the off season. But you will see a lot of assistants changing ships. And part of what fall ball is the coach to kind of evaluate you, first of all, and second of all, to kind of get his role down for when the season comes. It's like a dress rehearsal for your new assistant. You can hear all these great things and you hired him for a reason, but really fall ball is to vet the assistant and how he communicates with your players and how they communicate with your players, what's going to be his role in your system. And that's kind of the main thing for me going into it that I would look for. Especially if I'm watching a team that has a new assistant, even as a new head coach, that's also true for the head coach. It's just less likely an outcome, less frequent. And I think the second thing is you get a great look at your rookies. You get a great look at the freshmen. And I think that's really the value of fall ball is seeing, you know, did this kid, I mean, maybe you've seen him play in a couple tournaments, even though he's coming to play for your team, he wants to stay fresh. Hopefully he's stayed in shape in the last couple months or month, depending on the last time you saw him. You know, maybe he didn't. And it's time to have a little, let's get to the weight room talk with him, or let's keep our, let's watch our calorie intake talk. That's less so at the Division I level, but D2 and D3, that's definitely a thing that you have to measure and understand with freshmen, and also indoctrinating them into your program, not just their role on the field, but their role off the field as well. What's your system? Do you have a pecking order? Do you have a buddy system? Do you have, chores that rookies do? Do they have to report to you for extra study hall? Things like that are a big part of what makes a program successful. And I think those are things that maybe you won't see on the field in the spring and maybe won't really be talked about, but they give the coaches, and if you're looking close enough, the media, a good representation of how that player fits into your program and how your program fits that player.
Absolutely. And I definitely agree with those two takes. I think a third big one that is worth adding is you get to see, occasionally you have situations where like a program has lost their LSM and they maybe had somebody down at close who could play LSM, and you're looking at seeing which of those guys gets to bump up to be the new LSM. Or a lot of times almost every college program has one or more high school attackmen who've been converted into midfielders. And so occasionally when attack spots open up, guys will get bumped back up to attack. And in a lot of cases, those are sort of subjective decisions in terms of which attackman or does an attackman get moved back to, or a former high school attackman get moved back to attack. That you sort of take them out of competition with the other midfielders and move them sometimes into a case where they really don't have any real competition, either at LSM or attack or a spot like that. And so, for the most part, that sort of guarantees their spot starting at attack. Like, you're not going to take one of your first line midfielders and move them to attack if they're not going to start.
Correct.
And so I think you get some potentially good information from that. Just for example, one big example that last year is Kyle Jackson of Michigan was moved from midfield to be the new lefty attackman. And he killed it this spring and last fall at that lefty spot. I think had a hat trick in just about every game that he played. He did miss some time. And that was something that I saw in the fall. You got to look at what their offense looked like with him at attack. And I think there's a couple guys, a similar guy who I maybe have that question right now, at Johns Hopkins, with all those midfielders they have coming back. Does John Crawley get moved to become that righty attackman, to replace Ryan Brown?
Yeah, I mean, the other thing too, like, we're kind of skating around. Like, I don't have a huge opinion on fall ball that's positive other than the two points that I made. And actually, I agree with some of your takes on this third point as well. I just think it's so easy as someone watching fall ball to be like, oh man, this team looks so good. I bet they're going to be good in the spring. And they never are. Like, you can go watch, you know, any team and they can look terrible and they're still a top 10 team no matter what. Do you know what I mean? Like, yes, the parity is better. You see other teams come in there was a lot of upsets this past season. But I've gone to, you know, and I've talked to people that have gone to fall balls and the team looks unbeatable in a fall ball practice with themselves. And then they go like 4-10.
Well, I think if you're saying a team looks unbeatable playing against themselves, any team, no matter how good, can, you know, you can always look good against yourself. I would say more in scrimmages. Teams can look fantastic in scrimmages.
Oh,
and
sure.
And I think a lot of that depends on how much of your sort of 6-on-6, your 10v10 clear, those type schemes do you put in and emphasize in the fall versus how much do you just do more individual focused work and work on building up skill sets of players rather than schemes. Because a team in the fall that has put in their, you know, has put in their offense is probably going to look better in a scrimmage than a team that hasn't.
Yeah, I mean, are you familiar with the term practice hero?
Yes.
it's very easy to be a practice hero in fall ball. And practice hero extends to scrimmages. There's people that don't believe that. I fully 100% believe that practice heroes are just as good in practice as they are in scrimmages, and then they fade in games. And I think, you know, it's a psychological thing. I don't think it's connected necessarily to your ability. I think it's just kind of how you approach things mentally. But, you know, there's people that are just, there's players at every level, even professional level. They're good enough to be on a pro team, but they don't put up a ton of stats because they're practice heroes. And practice hero, you need practice heroes on teams, but at the same time, like, it's really easy to get fooled in a scrimmage or practice watching a player that's really good and then being like, how does he have 2 goals this year? It's weird.
And with that, I think we're going to call it a wrap on our portion of the podcast today.
You're going to talk to someone after this.
Maybe. We've already done 45 minutes or so. So maybe I'll just save it for the next podcast.
If that's what you want to do, that's what you want to do. I'm down for that.
It depends on how long it goes. We'll see. I am recording a segment with a guest. It may run in this podcast, maybe in the next one.
But either way, I'm Kyle Devitt. I'm the gear and lifestyle editor at Inside the Cross. You can find me at the Kyle Devitt on Twitter and Instagram.
And I am Patrick McEwen, also known as the Lacrosse Film Room guy. You can find me at Lax Film Room on Twitter and Snapchat, and at Lacrosse Film Room on Instagram and YouTube. And especially, I just dropped a bunch of MLL YouTube highlight videos this week, so go check those out.
No requests. Anyways.
What?
No requests.
Oh. I mean, you can make them, and I like read them, but it's not gonna influence me that much.
Bye, guys.
Okay. Bye. We'll talk to you next week.